Can we visit the ocean tomorrow, Papa?
Probably not tomorrow.
Where is Uncle Etienne?
I expect he's in his room on the fifth floor.
Seeing things that are not there?
We are lucky to have him, Murray.
Lucky to have Madame Manic, too. She's a genius with food, isn't she, Papa? She is maybe just a little bit better at cooking than you are.
Just a very little bit better.
Marie-Laure is glad to hear a smile enter his voice. But beneath it she can sense his thoughts fluttering like trapped birds. What does it mean, Papa, they'll occupy us?
It means they'll park their trucks in the squares.
Will they make us speak their language?
They might make us advance our clocks by 1 hour.
The house creaks. Gulls cry. He lights another cigarette. Is it like occupation, Papa? Like the sort of job a person does?
It's like military control, Murray. That's enough questions for now.
Quiet.
20 heartbeats. 30.
How can one country make another change its clocks? What if everybody refuses?
Then a lot of people will be early. Or late.
Remember our apartment, Papa? With my books and our model and all those pine cones on the windowsill?
Of course.
I lined up the pine cones largest to smallest.
They're still there.
Do you think so?
I know so.
You do not know so.
I do not know so. I believe so.
Are German soldiers climbing into our beds right now, Papa?
No.
Marie-Laure tries to lie very still. She can almost hear the machinery of her father's mind churning inside his skull. It will be okay, she whispers. Her hand finds his forearm. We will stay here a while, and then we will go back to our apartment, and the pine cones will be right where we left them, and 20,000 leagues under the sea will be on the floor of the key pound where we left it, and no one will be in our beds. The distant anthem of the sea, the clopping of someone's boot heels on cobbles far below. She wants very badly for her father to say, "Yes, that's it, absolutely, ma chérie." But he says nothing. Don't tell lies. He cannot concentrate on schoolwork or simple conversations or Frau Elena's chores. Every time he shuts his eyes, some vision of the school at Schulpforte overmasters him. Vermilion flags, muscular horses, gleaming laboratories. The best boys in Germany. At certain moments he sees himself as an emblem of possibility to which all eyes have turned. Though at other moments, flickering in front of him, he sees the big kid from the entrance exams, his face gone bloodless atop the platform high above the dance hall. How he fell. How no one moved to help him. Why can't Jutta be happy for him? Why, even at the moment of his escape, must some inexplicable warning murmur in a distant region of his mind? Martin Saxa says, "Tell us again about the hand grenades."
Siegfried Fischer says, "And the falconries."
3 times he readies his argument, and 3 times Jutta turns on a heel and strides away. Hour after hour she helps Frau Elena with the smaller children, or walks to the market, or finds some other excuse to be helpful, to be busy, to be out.
She won't listen, Werner tells Frau Elena.
Keep trying. Before he knows it, there's only 1 day before his departure. He wakes before dawn and finds Jutta asleep in her cot in the girls' dormitory. Her arms are wrapped around her head and her wool blanket is twisted around her midsection, and her pillow is jammed into the crack between mattress and wall. Even in sleep, a tableau of friction. Above her bed are papered her fantastical pencil drawings of Frau Elena's village, of Paris with a thousand white towers beneath whirling flocks of birds. He says her name. She twines herself tighter into her blanket. "Will you walk with me?" To his surprise, she sits up. They step outside before anyone else is awake. He leads her without speaking. They climb one fence, then another. Yuta's untied shoelaces trail behind her. Thistles bite their knees. The rising sun makes a pinhole on the horizon. They stop at the edge of an irrigation canal. In winters past, Werner used to tow her in their wagon to this very spot, and they would watch skaters race along the frozen canal, farmers with blades fixed to their feet, and frost caked in their beards, five or six rushing by all at once, tightly packed, in the midst of an 8 or 9 mile race between towns. The look in the skaters' eyes was of horses who have run a long way, and it was always exciting for Werner to see them, to feel the air disturbed by their speed, to hear the skates clapping along, then fading, a sensation as if his soul might tear free of his body and go sparking off with them. But as soon as they'd continued around the bend and left behind only the white etchings of their skates in the ice, the thrill would fade, and he'd tow Yuta back to Children's House, feeling lonely and forsaken, and more trapped in his life than before. He says, "No skaters came last winter." His sister gazes into the ditch. Her eyes are mauve. Her hair is snarled and untamable, and perhaps even whiter than his. Schnee. She says, "None'll come this year either." The mine complex is a smoldering black mountain range behind her. Even now, Werner can hear a mechanical drumbeat thudding in the distance, first shift going down in the elevators as the owl shift comes up, all those boys with tired eyes and soot-stained faces rising in the elevators to meet the sun. And for a moment he apprehends a huge and terrible presence looming just beyond the morning. "I know you're angry. You'll become just like Hans and Heribert." "I won't." "Spend enough time with boys like that and you will." "So you want me to stay? Go down in the mines?" They watch a bicyclist far down the path. Yuta clamps her hands in her armpits. "You know what I used to listen to? On our radio? Before you ruined it?" "Hush, Yuta, please." "Broadcasts from Paris. They'd say the opposite of everything Deutschlandsender says. They'd say we were devils, that we were committing atrocities. Do you know what atrocities means?" "Please, Yuta." "Is it right," Yuta says, "to do something only because everyone else is doing it?" Doubts slipping in like eels. Werner shoves them back. Yuta is barely 12 years old, still a child. "I'll write you letters every week. Twice a week if I can. You don't have to show them to Frau Elena if you don't want to." Yuta shuts her eyes. "It's not forever, Yuta. 2 years, maybe. Half the boys who get admitted don't manage to graduate. But maybe I'll learn something. Maybe they'll teach me to be a proper engineer. Maybe I can learn to fly an airplane, like little Siegfried says." "Don't shake your head. We've always wanted to see the inside of an airplane, haven't we? I'll fly us west. You and me. Frau Elena, too, if she wants. Or we could take a train. We'll ride through forests and mountain villages. All those places Frau Elena talked about when we were small. Maybe we could just ride all the way to Paris." The burgeoning light. The tender hiss of the grass. Yuta opens her eyes but doesn't look at him. "Don't tell lies. Lie to yourself, Werner. But don't lie to me." 10 hours later, he's on a train. Etienne. For 3 days, she does not meet her great-uncle. Then, feeling her way to the toilet on the fourth morning after their arrival, she steps on something small and hard. She crouches and locates it with her fingers. Whorled and smooth. A sculpture of vertical folds incised by a tapering spiral. The aperture broad and oval. She whispers, "A whelk." One stride in front of the first shell, she finds another. Then a third and a fourth. The trail of seashells arcs past the toilet and down a flight to the closed fifth-floor door she knows by now is his, beyond which issues the concerted whispers of pianos playing. A voice says, "Come in." She expects fustiness. An elderly funk, but the room smells mildly of soap and books and dried seaweed. Not unlike Dr. Geffard's laboratory. "Great uncle?" "Marie Lore." His voice is low and soft. A piece of silk you might keep in a drawer and pull out only on rare occasions just to feel it between your fingers. She reaches into space, and a cool bird-boned hand takes hers. "He is feeling better," he says. "I am sorry I have not been able to meet you sooner." The pianos plink along softly. It sounds as if a dozen are playing all at once, as if the sound comes from every point of the compass. "How many radios do you have, uncle?" "Let me show you." He brings her hands to a shelf. "This one is stereo. Heterodyne. I assembled it myself." She imagines a diminutive pianist, dressed in a tuxedo, playing inside the machine. Next, he places her hands on a big cabinet radio. Then on a third, no bigger than a toaster. 11 sets in all," he says, boyish pride slipping into his voice. "I can hear ships at sea. Madrid, Brazil, London. I heard Pakistan once. Here at the edge of the city, so high in the house, we get superb reception." He lets her dig through a box of fuses, another of switches. He leads her to bookshelves next, the spines of hundreds of books, a birdcage, beetles in a matchbox, an electric mousetrap, a glass paperweight inside which, he says, a scorpion has been entombed, jars of miscellaneous fuses, 100 more things she cannot identify. He has the entire fifth floor. One big room, except for the landing, to himself. 3 windows open onto the Rue Vauburel in the front, 3 more onto the alley in the back. There is a small ancient bed, his coverlet smooth and tight. A tidy desk, a davenport. "That's the tour," he says, almost whispering. Her great uncle seems kind, curious, entirely sane. Stillness. This is what he radiates more than anything else. The stillness of a tree. Of a mouse blinking in the dark. Madame Manic brings sandwiches. Etienne doesn't have any Jules Verne, but he does have Darwin, he says, and reads to her from The Voyage of the Beagle, translating English to French as he goes. "The variety of species among the jumping spiders appears almost infinite." Music spirals out of the radios, and it is splendid to drowse on the davenport, to be warm and fed, to feel the sentences hoist her up and carry her somewhere else. 6 blocks away at the telegraph office, Marie-Laure's father presses his face to the window to watch 2 German motorcycles with sidecars roar through the Port Saint-Vincent. The shutters of the town are drawn, but between slats, over sills, 1,000 eyes peer out. Behind the motorcycles roll 2 trucks. In the rear glides a single black Mercedes. Sunlight flashes from the hood ornaments and chrome fittings as the little procession grinds to a stop on the ringed gravel drive in front of the soaring, lichen-streaked walls of the Chateau de Saint-Malo. An elderly, preternaturally tanned man. The mayor, somebody explains. waits with a white handkerchief in his big sailor's hands, a barely perceptible shake showing in his wrists. The Germans climb out of their vehicles, more than a dozen of them. Their boots gleam, their uniforms are tidy. Two carry carnations. One urges along a beagle on a rope. Several gaze open-mouthed up at the facade of the chateau. A short man in a field captain's uniform emerges from the back seat of the Mercedes and brushes something invisible from the sleeve of his coat. He exchanges a few words with a thin aide-de-camp, who translates to the mayor. The mayor nods. Then the short man disappears through the huge doors. Minutes later, the aide-de-camp flings open the shutters of an upstairs window and gazes a moment across the rooftops before unfurling a crimson flag over the brick and securing its eyelets to the sill. Jungmänner. It's a castle out of a storybook. 8 or 9 stone buildings sheltered below hills, rust-colored roofs, narrow windows, spires and turrets, weeds sprouting from between roof tiles. A pretty little river winds through athletic fields. Not in the clearest hour of Zollverein's clearest day has Werner breathed air so unadulterated by dust. A one-armed bunkmaster sets forth rules in a belligerent torrent. This is your parade uniform, this is your field uniform, this is your gym uniform. Suspenders crossed in the back, parallel in the front. Sleeves rolled to the elbow. Each boy is to carry a knife in a scabbard on the right side of his belt. Raise your right arm when you wish to be called upon. Always a line in rows of 10. No books, no cigarettes, no food, no personal possessions, nothing in your locker but uniforms, boots, knife, polish. No talking after lights out. Letters home will be posted on Wednesdays. You will strip away your weakness, your cowardice, your hesitation. You will become like a waterfall, a volley of bullets. You will all surge in the same direction at the same pace toward the same cause. You will forego comforts. You will live by duty alone. You will eat country and breathe nation. Do they understand? The boys shout that they do. There are 400 of them, plus 30 instructors and 50 more on the staff, NCOs and cooks, groomsmen and groundskeepers. Some cadets are as young as 9. The oldest are 17. Gothic faces, sharp noses, pointed chins, blue eyes, all of them. Werner sleeps in a tiny dormitory with 7 other 14-year-olds. The bunk above belongs to Frederick. A reedy boy, thin as a blade of grass, skin as pale as cream. Frederick is new, too. He's from Berlin. His father is assistant to an ambassador. When Frederick speaks, his attention floats up as though he's scanning the sky for something. He and Werner eat their first meal in their starchy new uniforms at a long wooden table in the refectory. Some boys talk in whispers, some sit alone. Some gulp food as if they have not eaten in days. Through 3 arched windows, dawn sends a sheaf of hallowed golden rays. Frederick flutters his fingers and asks, "Do you like birds?" "Sure." "Do you know about hooded crows?" Werner shakes his head. "Hooded crows are smarter than most mammals, even monkeys. I've seen them put nuts they can't crack in the road and wait for cars to run over them to get at the kernel. Werner, you and I are going to be great friends, I'm sure of it." A portrait of the Führer glowers over every classroom. Learning happens on backless benches at wooden tables grooved by the boredom of countless boys before them. Squires, monks, conscripts, cadets. On Werner's first day, he walks past the half-open door of the technical sciences laboratory and glimpses a room as big as Zollverein's drugstore, lined with brand-new sinks and glass-fronted cabinets inside which wait sparkling beakers and graduated cylinders and balances and burners. Frederick has to urge him along. On their second day, a withered phrenologist gives a presentation to the entire student body. The lights in the refectory dim. A projector whirls. and a chart full of circles appears on the far wall. The old man stands beneath the projection screen and whisks the tip of billiard cues through the grids. White circles represent pure German blood. Circles with black indicate the proportion of foreign blood. Notice group 2, number 5. He raps the screen with his cue and it ripples. Marriage between a pure German and one-quarter Jew is still permissible, you see. A half hour later, Werner and Frederick are reading Goethe in poetics. Then they're magnetizing needles in field exercises. The bunkmaster announces schedules of Byzantine complication. Mondays are for mechanics, state history, racial sciences. Tuesdays are for horsemanship, orienteering, military history. Everyone, even the 9-year-olds, will be taught to clean, break down, and fire a Mauser rifle. Afternoons, they lash themselves into a snarl of cartridge belts and run. Run to the troughs, run to the flag, run up the hill. Run carrying each other on your backs, run carrying your rifle above your head. Run, crawl, swim, then more running. The star-flooded nights, the dew-soaked dawns, the hushed ambulatories, the enforced asceticism. Never has Werner felt part of something so single-minded. Never has he felt such a hunger to belong. In the rows of dormitories are cadets who talk of alpine skiing, of duels, of jazz clubs and governesses, and boar hunting. Boys who employ curse words with virtuosic skill, and boys who talk about cigarettes named for cinema stars. Boys who speak of telephoning the colonel, and boys who have baronesses for mothers. There are boys who have been admitted not because they are good at anything in particular, but because their fathers work for ministries, and the way they talk, one mustn't expect figs from thistles. I'd pollinate her in a blink, you shit. Bear up and funk it, boys. There are cadets who do everything right. Perfect posture, expert marksmanship, boots polished so perfectly that they reflect clouds. There are cadets who have skin like butter, and irises like sapphires, and ultra-fine networks of blue veins laced across the backs of their hands. For now, though, beneath the whip of the administration, they are all the same. All Jungmänner. They hustle through the gates together, gulp fried eggs in the refectory together, march across the quadrangle, perform roll call, salute the colors, shoot rifles, run, bathe, and suffer together. They are each a mound of clay, and the potter that is the portly, shiny-faced commandant is throwing 400 identical pots. We are young, they sing. We are steadfast. We have never compromised. We have so many castles yet to storm. Werner sways between exhaustion, confusion, and exhilaration. That his life has been so wholly redirected astounds him. He keeps any doubts at bay by memorizing lyrics, or the routes to classrooms, by holding before his eyes a vision of the technical sciences laboratory. 9 tables, 30 stools, coils, variable capacitors, amplifiers, batteries, soldering irons locked away in those gleaming cabinets. Above him, kneeling on his bunk, Frederick peers out the open window through a pair of antique field glasses and makes a record on the bed rail of birds he has sighted. 1 notch under red-necked grebe, 6 notches under thrush nightingale. Out on the grounds, a group of 10-year-olds is carrying torches and swastika flags towards the river. The procession pauses, and a gust of wind tears at the torch flames. Then they march on, their song swirling up through the window like a bright, pulsing cloud. Oh, take me. Take me up into the ranks, so that I do not die a common death. I do not want to die in vain. What I want is to fall on the sacrificial mound. Vienna. Sergeant Major Reinhold von Rumpel is 41 years old, not so old that he cannot be promoted. He has moist red lips,
pale, almost translucent cheeks like fillets of raw sole, and an instinct for correctness that rarely fails him. He has a wife who suffers his absences without complaint and who arranges porcelain kittens by color, lightest to darkest, on two different shelves in their drawing room in Stuttgart. He also has two daughters whom he has not seen in 9 months. The eldest, Veronica, is deeply earnest. Her letters to him include phrases like sacred resolve, proud accomplishments, and unparalleled in history. Von Rumpel's particular gift is for diamonds. He can facet and polish stones as well as any Aryan jeweler in Europe, and he often spots fakes at a glance. He studied crystallography in Munich, apprenticed as a polisher in Antwerp, has even been, one glorious afternoon, to Charterhouse Street in London, to an unmarked diamond house, where he was asked to turn out his pockets and ushered up three staircases and through three locked doors, and seated at a table where a man with a mustache waxed to knife points let him examine a 92-carat raw diamond from South Africa. Before the war, the life of Reinhold von Rumpel was pleasant enough. He was a gemologist who ran an appraisal business out of a second-story shop behind Stuttgart's old chancellery. Clients would bring in stones, and he'd tell them what they were worth. Sometimes he'd recut diamonds or consult on high-level faceting projects. If occasionally he cheated a customer, he told himself that was part of the game. Because of the war, his job has expanded. Now Sergeant Major von Rumpel has the chance to do what no one has done in centuries. Not since the Mughal dynasty. Not since the Khans. Perhaps not in history. The capitulation of France is only weeks past, and already he has seen things he did not dream he would see in six lifetimes. A 17th century globe as big around as a small car, with rubies to mark volcanoes, sapphires clustered at the poles, and diamonds for world capitals. He has held, a dagger handle at least 400 years old, made of white jade and inlaid with emeralds. Just yesterday, on the road to Vienna, he took possession of a 570-piece china set with a single marquee-cut diamond set into the rim of every single dish. Where the police confiscated these treasures, and from whom, he does not ask. Already he has personally packed them into a crate and belted it shut, and numbered it with white paint and seen it loaded inside a train car where it sits under 24-hour guard. Waiting to be sent to high command. Waiting for more. This particular summer afternoon, in a dusty geological library in Vienna, Sergeant Major von Rumpel follows an underweight secretary wearing brown shoes, brown stockings, a brown skirt, and a brown blouse through a stack of periodicals. The secretary sets down a step stool, climbs, reaches. Tavernier's 1676 travels in India. P.S. Palace's 1793 travels through the southern provinces of the Russian Empire. Streeter's 1898, precious stones and gems. Rumor is that the Führer is compiling a wish list of precious objects from all around Europe and Russia. They say he intends to remake the Austrian town of Linz into an Empyrean city, the cultural capital of the world. A vast promenade, mausoleum, acropolis, planetarium, library, opera house, everything marble and granite, everything profoundly clean. At its core, he plans a kilometer-long museum, a trove of the greatest achievements in human culture. The document is real, von Rumpel has heard. 400 pages. He sits at a table in the stacks. He tries to cross his legs, but a slight swelling troubles his groin today. Odd, though not painful. The mousy librarian brings books. He pages slowly through the Tavernier, the Streeter, Murray's Sketches of Persia. He reads entries on the 300-carat Orloff diamond from Moscow, the Nur al-Ain, the 48.5-carat Dresden green. Toward evening, he finds it. The story of a prince who could not be killed.
a priest who warned of a goddess's wrath, a French prelate who believed he'd bought the same stone centuries later. Sea of flames. Grayish-blue with a red hue at its center. Recorded at 133 carats. Either lost or willed to the King of France in 1738, on the condition that it be locked away for 200 years. He looks up. Suspended lamps, rows of spines fading off into dusty gold. All of Europe, and he aims to find one pebble tucked inside its folds. The Bosch. Her father says their weapons gleam as if they have never been fired. He says their boots are clean and their uniforms spotless. He says they look as if they have just stepped out of air-conditioned train cars. The townswomen who stop by Madame Manick's kitchen door in ones and twos say the Germans, they refer to them as the Bosch, buy every postcard on every pharmacy rack. They say the Bosch buy straw dolls and candied apricots and stale cakes from the window of the confectionery. The Bosch buy shirts from Monsieur Verdier and lingerie from Monsieur Morvan. The Bosch require absurd quantities of butter and cheese. The Bosch have guzzled down every bottle of champagne the caviste would sell them. Hitler, the women whisper, is touring Parisian monuments. Curfews are installed. Music that can be heard outdoors is banned. Public dances are banned. The country is in mourning, and we must behave respectfully, announces the mayor. Though what authority he retains is not clear. Every time she comes within earshot, Marie-Laure hears the fss of her father lighting another match. His hands flutter between his pockets. Mornings he alternates between Madame Manick's kitchen, the tobacco shop, and the post office where he waits in interminable queues to use the telephone. Afternoons he repairs things around Etienne's house, a loose cabinet door, a squeaking stairboard. He asks Madame Manick about the reliability of the neighbors. He flips the locking clasp on his tool case over and over until Marie-Laure begs him to stop. One day Etienne sits with Marie-Laure and reads to her in his feathery voice. The next, he suffers from what he calls a headache and sequesters himself inside his study behind a locked door. Madame Manick sneaks Marie-Laure chocolate bars, slices of cake. This morning they squeeze lemons into glasses full of water and sugar, and she lets Marie-Laure drink as much as she likes. How long will he stay in there, Madame?
Sometimes just a day or two, Madame Manick says. Sometimes longer.
1 week in Saint-Malo becomes two. Marie begins to feel that her life, like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, has been interrupted halfway through. There was Volume 1, when Marie-Laure and her father lived in Paris and went to work, and now there's Volume 2, when Germans ride motorcycles through these strange, narrow streets, and her uncle vanishes inside his own house.
Papa, when will we leave?
As soon as I hear from Paris.
Why do we have to sleep in this little bedroom?
I'm sure we could clean out a downstairs room if you'd like.
What about the room across the hall from us?
Etienne and I agreed we would not use it.
Why not?
It belonged to your grandfather.
When can I go to the sea?
Not today, Marie.
Can't we go for a walk around the block?
It's too dangerous.
She wants to shriek.
What dangers await? When she opens her bedroom window, she hears no screams, no explosions, only the calls of birds that her great-uncle calls gannets and the sea, and the occasional throb of an airplane as it passes far overhead.
She spends her hours learning the house. The first floor belongs to Madame Manick, clean, navigable, full of visitors who come through the kitchen door to trade in small-town scandal. There's the dining room, the foyer, the hutch full of antique dishes in the hall that tremble whenever anyone walks past,
and a door off the kitchen that leads to Madame's room. A bed, a sink, a chamber pot. 11 winding steps lead to the second floor, which is full of the smells of faded grandeur. An old sewing room, a former maid's room. Right here on the landing, Madame Manic tells her, pallbearers dropped the coffin carrying Etienne's great-aunt. The coffin flipped over and she slid down the whole flight. They were all horrified, but she looked entirely unaffected. More clutter on the third floor. Boxes of jars, metal discs, and rusty jigsaws. Buckets of what might be electrical components. Engineering manuals in piles around a toilet. By the fourth floor, things are piled everywhere. In the rooms and corridors and along the staircase. Baskets of what must be machine parts. Shoeboxes loaded with screws, antique dollhouses built by her great-grandfather. Etienne's huge study colonizes the entire fifth floor, alternately deeply quiet or else full of voices or music or static. Then there's the sixth floor, her grandfather's tidy bedroom on the left, toilet straight ahead, the little room where she sleeps with her father on the right. When the wind is blowing, which it almost always is, with the walls groaning and the shutters banging, the rooms overloaded and the staircase wound tightly up through its center, the house seems the material equivalent of her uncle's inner being. Apprehensive, isolated, but full of cobwebby wonders. In the kitchen, Madame Manic's friends fuss over Marie-Laure's hair and freckles. In Paris, the women say, people are waiting in line 5 hours for a loaf of bread. People are eating pets, crushing pigeons with bricks for soup. There is no pork, no rabbit, no cauliflower. The headlights of cars are all painted blue, they say, and at night the city is as quiet as a graveyard. No buses, no trains, hardly any gasoline. Marie-Laure sits at the square table. A plate of cookies in front of her, and imagines the old woman with veiny hands and milky eyes and oversized ears. From the kitchen window comes the whit, whit, whit of a barn swallow. Footfalls on ramparts, halyards clinking against masts, hinges and chains creaking in the harbor. Ghosts. Germans. Snails.
Hauptmann. A rosy-cheeked and diminutive instructor of technical sciences named Dr. Hauptmann peels off his brass-buttoned coat and hangs it over the back of a chair. He orders the cadets in Werner's class to collect hinged metal boxes from a locked cabinet at the back of the laboratory. Inside each are gears, lenses, fuses, springs, shackles, and resistors. There's a fat coil of copper wire, a tiny instrument hammer, and a two-terminal battery as big as a shoe. Finer equipment than Werner has had access to in his life. The little professor stands at the chalkboard drawing a wiring schematic for a simple Morse code practice circuit. He sets down his chalk, presses his slender fingertips together 5 to 5, and asks the boys to assemble the circuit with the parts in their kits. You have 1 hour. Most of the boys blanch. They dump everything out on the tables and poke gingerly at the parts as if at trinkets imported from some future age. Frederick plucks random pieces out of his box and holds them to the light. For a moment, Werner is back inside his attic room at Children's House, his head a swarm of questions. What is lightning? How high could you jump if you lived on Mars? What is the difference between twice 25 and twice 5 and 20? Then he takes the battery, two rectangles of sheet metal, some penny nails, and the instrument hammer from his box. In under a minute, he has built an oscillator to match the schematic. The little professor frowns. He tests Werner's circuit, which works. Right, he says, and stands in front of Werner's table and laces his hands behind his back. Next, take from your kit the disc-shaped magnet, a wire, a screw, and your battery. Though his instructions seem meant for the class, he looks at Werner alone. This is all you may use. who can build a simple motor. Some boys stir the parts in their kits half-heartedly. Most simply watch. Werner feels Dr. Hauptmann's attention on him like a floodlight. He sticks the magnet to the screw's head and holds the screw's point to the positive terminal on the battery. When he runs the wire from the negative side of the battery to the head of the screw, both the screw and the magnet start to spin. The operation takes him no more than 15 seconds. Dr. Hauptmann's mouth is partially open. His face is flushed, adrenalized. "What is your name, cadet?"
"Fennig, sir."
"What else can you make?" Werner studies the parts on his table. "A doorbell, sir? Or a Morse beacon? An ohm meter?" The other boys crane their necks. Dr. Hauptmann's lips are pink and his eyelids are improbably thin, as though he is watching Werner even when he blinks. He says, "Make them all." Flying couch. Posters go up in the market, on tree trunks in the Place Chateaubriand. Voluntary surrender of firearms. Anyone who does not cooperate will be shot. At noon the following day, various Bretons troop in to drop off weapons. Farmers on mule carts from miles away, plodding old sailors with antique pistols, a few hunters with outrage in their eyes gazing at the floor as they turn in their rifles. In the end, it's a pathetic pile, maybe 300 weapons in all, half of them rusted. Two young gendarmes pile them into the back of a truck and drive up the narrow street and cross the causeway and are gone. No speeches, no explanations.
"Please, Papa, can't I go out?"
"Soon, little dove."
But he is distracted.
He smokes so much it is as if he is turning himself into ash. Lately he stays up working frenetically on a model of Saint-Malo that he claims is for her, adding new houses every day, framing ramparts, mapping streets so that she can learn the town the way she learned their neighborhood in Paris. Wood, glue, nails, sandpaper. Rather than comforting her, the noises and smells of his manic diligence make her more anxious. Why will she have to learn the streets of Saint-Malo? How long will they be here?
In the fifth-floor study, Marie-Laure listens to her great-uncle read another page of The Voyage of the Beagle. Darwin has hunted rheas in Patagonia, studied owls outside Buenos Aires, and scaled a waterfall in Tahiti. He pays attention to slaves, rocks, lightning, finches, and the ceremony of pressing noses in New Zealand. She loves especially to hear about the dark coasts of South America, with their impenetrable walls of trees and offshore breezes full of the stink of rotting kelp and the cries of whelping seals. She loves to imagine Darwin at night, leaning over the ship's rail to stare into bioluminescent waves, watching the tracks of penguins marked by fiery green wakes.
"Bonsoir," she says to Etienne, standing on the davenport in his study. "I may only be a girl of 12, but I am a brave French explorer who has come to help you with your adventures."
Etienne adopts a British accent.
"Oh, good evening, mademoiselle. Why don't you come to the jungle with me and eat these butterflies? They are as big as dinner plates and may not be poisonous. Who knows?"
"I would love to eat your butterflies, Monsieur Darwin, but first I will eat these cookies."
Other evenings they play flying couch. They climb onto the davenport and sit side by side, and Etienne says,
"Where tonight, mademoiselle?"
"The jungle."
Or
"Tahiti."
Or
"Mozambique."
"Oh, it's a long journey this time," Etienne will say in an entirely new voice, smooth, velvety, a conductor's drawl. "That's the Atlantic Ocean far below. It's shining under the moonlight. Can you smell it? Feel how cold it is up here. Feel the wind in your hair."
"Where are we now, uncle?"
"We're in Borneo, can't you tell?
We're skimming the treetops now. Big leaves are glimmering below us, and there are coffee bushes over there. Smell them. And Marie-Laure will indeed smell something. Whether because her uncle is passing coffee grounds beneath her nose, or because they really are flying over the coffee trees of Borneo, she does not want to decide. They visit Scotland, New York City, Santiago. More than once they put on winter coats and visit the moon. Can't you feel how lightweight we are, Murray? You can move by hardly twitching a muscle. He sets her in his wheeled desk chair and pants as he whirls her in circles until she cannot laugh any more for the pain of it. Here, try some nice fresh moon flesh, he says, and into her mouth goes something that tastes a lot like cheese. Always at the end they sit side by side and pound the cushions, and slowly the room rematerializes around them. Ah, he says more quietly, his accent fading, the faintest touch of dread returning to his voice. Here we are. Home. The Sum of Angles. Werner is summoned to the office of the technical sciences professor. A trio of sleek, long-legged hounds swirl around him as he enters. The room is lit by a pair of green-shaded banker's lamps, and in the shadows, Werner can see shelves crowded with encyclopedias, models of windmills, miniature telescopes, prisms. Dr. Hauptmann stands behind his big desk wearing his brass-buttoned coat, as though he too has just arrived. Tight curls frame his ivory forehead. He tugs off his leather gloves one finger at a time. Drop a log on the fire, please. Werner tacks across the room and stirs the coals to life. In the corner, he realizes, sits a third person. A massive figure camped sleepily in an armchair intended for a much smaller man. He is Frank Folkheimer, an upperclassman, 17 years old, a colossal boy from some boreal village. A legend among the younger cadets. Supposedly, Folkheimer has carried 3 first years across the river by holding them above his head. Supposedly, he has lifted the tail end of the commandant's automobile high enough to slip a jack under the axle. There is a rumor that he crushed a communist windpipe with his hands. Another that he grabbed the muzzle of a stray dog and cut out its eyes just to inure himself to the suffering of other beings. They call him the Giant. Even in the low, flickering light, Werner sees that veins climb Folkheimer's forearms like vines. A student has never built the motor, says Hauptmann, his back partially to Folkheimer. Not without help. Werner does not know how to reply, so he does not. He pokes the fire one last time, and sparks rise up the chimney. Can you do trigonometry, cadet?
Only what I've been able to teach myself, sir.
Hauptmann takes a sheet of paper from a drawer and writes on it. Do you know what this is? Werner squints. L equals D over tangent alpha, plus D over tangent beta.
A formula, sir.
Do you comprehend its uses?
I believe it is a way to use 2 known points to find the location of a third and unknown point.
Hauptmann's blue eyes glitter. He looks like someone who has discovered something very valuable lying right in front of him on the ground. If I give you the known points and a distance between them, cadet, can you solve it? Can you draw the triangle?
I believe so.
Sit at my desk, Fennig. Take my chair. Here is a pencil. When he sits in the desk chair, the toes of Werner's boots do not reach the ground. The fire pumps heat into the room. Block out giant Frank Folkheimer with his mammoth boots and cinder-block jaw. Block out the little aristocratic professor pacing in front of the hearth and the late hour and the dogs and the shelves brimming with interesting things. There is only this.
tangent A equals sine A over cosine A. And sine A plus beta equals sine A cosine beta plus cosine A sine beta. Now D can be moved to the front of the equation. D equals L sine alpha sine beta over sine alpha plus beta.
Werner plugs Hauptmann's numbers into the equation. He imagines two observers in a field pacing out the distance between them, then leveling their eyes on a far-off landmark, a sailing ship or a smokestack. When Werner asks for a slide rule, the professor slips one onto the desk immediately, having expected the request. Werner takes it without looking and begins to calculate the signs. Volkheimer watches. The little doctor paces, hands behind his back. The fire pops. The only sounds are the breathing of the dogs and clicking of the slide rule's cursor. Eventually, Werner says, 16.43, Herr Doktor. He draws the triangle and labels the distances of each segment and passes the paper back. Hauptmann checks something in a leather book. Volkheimer shifts slightly in his chair. His gaze is both interested and indolent. The professor presses one of his palms flat to the desk while reading, frowning absently, as though waiting for a thought to pass. Werner is seized with a sudden and foreboding dread. But then Hauptmann looks back at him, and the feeling subsides. It says in your application papers that when you leave here you wish to study electrical mechanics in Berlin. And you are an orphan, is that correct? Another glance at Volkheimer. Werner nods. My sister... A scientist's work, cadet, is determined by two things. His interests and the interests of his time. Do you understand? I think so. We live in exceptional times, cadet. A thrill enters Werner's chest. Firelit rooms lined with books. These are the places in which important things happen. You will work in the laboratory after dinner. Every night, even Sundays. Yes, sir. Start tomorrow. Yes, sir. Volkheimer here will keep an eye out for you. Take these biscuits. The professor produces a tin with a bow on it. And breathe, Fennig. You cannot hold your breath every time you're in my laboratory. Yes, sir. Cold air whistles through the halls, so pure it makes Werner dizzy. A trio of moths swim against the ceiling of his bunk room. He unlaces his boots and folds his trousers in the dark and sets the tin of biscuits on top. Frederick peers over the edge of his bunk. Where did you go? I got cookies, whispers Werner. I heard an owl tonight. Hush, hisses a boy two bunks down. Werner passes up a biscuit. Frederick whispers, Do you know about them? They're really rare. Big as gliders. This one was probably a young male looking for new territory. He was in one of the poplar trees beside the parade ground. Oh, says Werner. Greek letters move across the undersides of his eyelids. Isosceles triangles, betas, sine curves. He sees himself in a white coat striding past machines. Someday he'll probably win a big prize. Code-breaking, rocket propulsion, all the latest. We live in exceptional times. From the hall come the clicking boot heels of the bunkmaster. Frederick tips back onto his bunk. I couldn't see him, he whispers. But I heard him perfectly. Shut your face, says a second boy. You'll get us thrashed. Frederick says nothing more. Werner stops chewing. The bunkmaster's boots go quiet. Either he is gone or he has paused outside the door. Out on the grounds, someone is splitting wood, and Werner listens to the ringing of the sledgehammer against the wedge and the quick, frightened breaths of the boys all around him.
The Professor. Etienne is reading Darwin to Marie-Laure when he stops mid-syllable.
Uncle?
He breathes nervously. Out of pursed lips, as if blowing on a spoonful of hot soup, he whispers,
"Someone's here."
Marie-Laure can hear nothing. No footfalls, no knocks. Madame Manic whisks a broom across the landing one floor up. Etienne hands her the book. She can hear him unplug a radio, then tangle himself in its cords.
"Uncle?"
she says again. But he is leaving his study, floundering downstairs. Are they in danger? And she follows him to the kitchen, where she can hear him laboring to slide the kitchen table out of the way. He pulls up a ring in the center of the floor. Beneath a hatch waits a square hole out of which washes a damp, frightening smell.
"One step down. Hurry now."
Is this a cellar? What has her uncle seen? She has set one foot on the top rung of a ladder when the blocky shoes of Madame Manic come clomping into the kitchen.
"Really, Master Etienne, please."
Etienne's voice from below.
"I heard something. Someone."
"You are frightening her. It's nothing, Marie-Laure. Come now." Marie-Laure backs out. Below her, her great-uncle whispers nursery rhymes to himself.
"I can sit with him for a bit, madame. Maybe we could read some more of our book, uncle."
The cellar, she gathers, is merely a dank hole in the ground. They sit a while on a rolled carpet with the trapdoor open, and listen to Madame Manic hum as she makes tea in the kitchen above them. Etienne trembles lightly beside her.
"Did you know," says Marie-Laure, "that the chance of being hit by lightning is one in a million? Dr. Geffard told me that."
"In 1 year or in one lifetime?"
"I'm not sure."
"You should have asked." Again, those quick, pursed exhalations, as though his whole body urges him to flee.
"What happens if you go outside, uncle?"
"I get uneasy."
His voice is almost inaudible. "But what makes you uneasy?"
"Being outside."
"What part?"
"Big spaces."
"Not all spaces are big. Your street is not that big, is it?"
"Not as big as the streets you are used to."
"You like eggs and figs and tomatoes. They were in our lunch. They grow outside." He laughs softly.
"Of course they do."
"Don't you miss the world?"
He is quiet. So is she. Both ride spirals of memory.
"I have the whole world here," he says, and taps the cover of Darwin. "And in my radios. Right at my fingertips."
Her uncle seems almost a child, monastic in the modesty of his needs and wholly independent of any sort of temporal obligations. And yet she can tell he is visited by fears so immense, so multiple, that she can almost feel the terror pulsing inside him, as though some beast breathes all the time at the window panes of his mind.
"Could you read some more, please?" she asks.
And Etienne opens the book and whispers,
"Delight itself is a weak term to express the feelings of a naturalist who, for the first time, has wandered by himself into a Brazilian forest."
After a few paragraphs, Marie-Laure says without preamble,
"Tell me about that bedroom upstairs, across from the one I sleep in."
He stops. Again, his quick, nervous breaths.
"There's a little door at the back of it," she says. "But it's locked. What's through there?"
He is silent for long enough that she worries she has upset him. But then he stands and his knees crack like twigs.
"Are you getting one of your headaches, uncle?"
"Come with me."
They wind all the way up the stairs. On the 6th floor landing, they turn left, and he pushes open the door to what was once her grandfather's room. She has already run her hands over its contents many times. A wooden oar nailed to a wall,
a window dressed with long curtains, single bed, model ship on a shelf. At the back stands a wardrobe so large she cannot reach its top, nor stretch her arms wide enough to touch